Hello, I'm Allison from Kunlun. I'm the marketing head of Game Club Koala. Now you are listening to Scene World Podcast.
Sup? It is the Scene World Podcast. I'm AJ. That is Jurg over there. I'm on adventures. I'm not in my normal spot.
Right.
And in a minute, we'll be talking to Antoine Goua and Sylvain Gadois.
Also known as Roger Bidon.
Yes, indeed. The creators of Super Tilt Brothers.
Well, actually, Roger Bidon is the creator, and Antoine Goua, it's actually the publisher.
Correct.
The publisher co-owner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Prog Studio.
Correct.
And we will be talking to them about the latest project called Super Tilt Pro, which is a brawler for the NES that... Mm-hmm.
Has a twist.
Well, that has a twist in the way that it contains a Wi-Fi adapter inside the cartridge. So the game was released before without the online functionality, and now is re-released as an extended version with the hardware inside.
Right.
And Antoine, who is working for their publisher, Prog Studio, is also, as we learned, the designer of the hardware side of the cartridge during the interview. So in this interview, we kind of mix between talking about the history and what the studio is doing, and also what Roger Bidon or Sylvain
handles
the game.
Yeah.
So it's actually kind of two interview topics entwined into one. And so this is also, which is very fortunate for us, the first time the two are doing an interview in English together. For Roger, it's actually the first time he did an English interview. And for Antoine, he did an English interview before. So this is his second time. Yeah, so as we force people to speak English with us, it's you could say it's kind of exclusive. And their Kickstarter was an instant success. I mean,
yeah,
they wanted a lot of money, and in the end, they got €89,491 by 1,133 backers, and I was one of them. And they are right now in the last stages of releasing the game. And after it has been shipped to all the Kickstarter backers, you can actually buy, just like all the past games the Prog Studio released, on their online store as well, so it's not in a Kickstarter exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a very, very interesting interview, I think. I'm very happy that we managed to get it. But before, though, we have some news.
Yes, indeed.
But it's not so many news this time.
Yeah, maybe I got no news. I looked. I didn't see anything new happening. So you've got... All the
news. There are some news. So let's start with the first one. Roman Werner, a German Swiss, game developer that actually was a pioneer on the Amiga side.
Mm-hmm.
Actually announced there will be a new C64 game announced on his itch.io page.
Okay.
On Easter Monday, which is also April 1st, at 10 a.m. GMT plus one.
Okay.
So,
okay.
The page says, get ready. Some points about the game. 6 months in the making, handcrafted with love for your enjoyment by the team who brought Bill and Ted's excellent Game Boy Adventures to the C64.
Okay.
Yeah. So, let's see. To this day, it's 7 days left, 14 hours, and 33 minutes until this is announced with more details.
Okay.
So we'll link to the revealing page.
By the time you see this, it won't be pending anymore. It'll be out. You'll be able to see it.
I'm not sure if we will. It's seven days to.
Oh, seven. I thought it was 14 hours. I missed the days.
7 days, 14 hours.
So there might be a couple of days by when you're watching.
Right.
There might be a few days left on this.
Okay. Other news. Slipgate Ironworks and 3D Realms are no longer part of the Embracer Group.
Oh.
Our parent company, Frederick Schreiber says, Saber Interactive has left the Embracer Group.
Okay.
They are now operating as a privately owned company. And it's actually in their press announcement of the Embracer Group. That's actually just a side note, because the heading is actually a different one. And the heading is as follows. Embracer Group ceases all operations in Russia through the de-investment of selected assets from the operative group Saber Interactive.
Right.
And
right,
then okay. Down the text, transactions key components, there is also the part that I just quoted from Frederick Schreiber's announcement on his Facebook and LinkedIn profile.
Interesting.
Another group.
So does that mean that Saber is Russian then? Because
no, it's not. If
Embracer is trying to if they're divesting because they're trying to cease operations in Russia by getting rid of certain things, you would think the things they're getting rid of would be Russian entities.
Well, I guess they made it like the key factor that they no longer support Russia, and then as a consequence, we also keys the following. All those companies involved are usually Scandinavian.
Right.
You know, I mean, for example, if they're
Finnish, I mean, Finland does have some relation to Russia, so they might be, even though Finland is trying to kind of get away from that because of what's happened in Ukraine and whatnot, and they've become, I believe they're part of NATO now, but
they are.
Yeah. But Russia still.
Hungary was the only European country not joining, and they actually managed to convince Orban to agree. So they were allowed to join NATO, yeah.
But then, so they're now, so they were a part of Embracer. Now they're part of, so Embracer is Swedish. Yeah, Embracer Group is a Swedish holding company.
Exactly.
Saber is American. They're based out of Fort Lauderdale in Florida. They are now a subsidiary of, they've left Embracer, but they're now part of Beacon Interactive as of 2024. So what is Beacon Interactive?
I mean, this
it's so intertwined. It's so
I know.
A web of nonsense with these things.
I know.
Okay, they are Beacon Interactive. That's not it at all. This is something totally different. This is like the Department of Defense. Okay, Beacon Interactive. Okay, so this is 10 days ago. Beacon Interactive acquired Saber for $247 million. So
by
Embracer sold them. Embracer sold them. Okay. Agreed to sell select assets, including Saber. Terminating all of its business. Oh, in addition. Okay, so all its business activities in Russia as part of the divestment. And so, but they don't say Embracer Group. Who knows? Okay, Beacon Interactive, a company controlled by Matthew Karch, one of the co-founders of Saber Interactive. Okay, so Beacon Interactive is controlled by one of the founders of Saber Interactive. So basically, the guy that runs Saber Interactive bought himself. So confusing. I need like a flow chart, like diagrams and things. It's
I know.
Steam World is not part of any larger holding company.
No. Well, it's
family of products.
It became complicated at that point where the Swedish game publisher, Nordic Entertainment.
Yeah.
Was actually buying the bankrupt THQ Nordic.
Mm-hmm.
THQ. Then they became THQ Nordic. Then we learned that THQ Nordic as a whole is just a part of the bigger Embracer crew. And then as we learned, the Embracer group started buying the IPs, anything retro, Amiga IPs, like Alone in the Dark, that was also just released, I think 4 days ago of this recording. Forgot to mention it in my file, but Alone in the Dark is actually rebooted, and they finally rebooted it. And, you know, and so it all started around 2016 when we first got in touch with them. And since then, it all became very complicated. So in the end, this whole thing became bigger than EA or whatever, you know. And so amazing.
It's all, you know, these conglomerates. It's, you know, cars are like this too. You've got, you know, like currently one of the biggest conglomerates with that is this thing called Stellantis, which is a Dutch company, but it owns Abarth, Alfa Romeo, Chrysler, Citroen, Dodge, DS, Fiat, Jeep, Lancia, Maserati, Opel, Peugeot, Ram, Vauxhall, all these different car companies. This one company owns, and it's like you think, like, you know, oh, you know, again, a Jeep. Okay, but one of my favorite analogies here, you know, cool, you know, it's the Jeep, it's, you know, the quintessential American SUV and whatnot. Nuh-uh. It's part of Fiat Chrysler, which is French at this point, but that in turn is owned by a company from Amsterdam.
All right.
It's ridiculous. It's just,
okay.
It's,
so just in case you missed it, because HJ is ranting, the latest game THQ Nordic actually released is a remake of the original Alone in the Dark from '93, that was released for the Amiga and for the PC.
Right.
I think it was like 4 days ago at the time of this recording. And it's a AAA title, so it's when I looked at it in Germany, it was a whopping €59. So on Steam.
Okay.
So still okay. When you notice, still okay when you notice that other publishers like EA last December raised their AAA game title from 59 to 79 as an entrance price.
Well, either that or they try to do the subscription model, which is even more expensive in the long run.
Well, subscription model didn't work out too well, so... Nah. Well, you more have companies going either towards free-to-play or a higher...
Oh, that and free-to-play is often that microtransaction shit. That's even worse.
I know.
Hate that.
Anyway, so Alone in the Dark has been released. And, And another thing has been released also a few days ago, and that is the former exclusive PlayStation 4 5 title for the PC, Horizon Forbidden Forest. And the PC version is actually entitled Horizon Forbidden Best Complete Edition. Don't know why it's called Complete Edition. I guess it has some DLCs.
Does it have anything to do with the old Forbidden Forest game, or is it totally just a coincidence?
It has nothing to do with the Forbidden Forest games from Cosme, but I know what you mean.
Yeah,
I actually have an original copy of that game.
Me too.
And the funny thing is, you know, that it was a low cost publisher back then in 85. Mm-hmm. And it totally looks like homemade.
Mm-hmm. Mine too. Yep. It's like a typed out label.
To the extent that the label isn't aligned correctly to the disc. It's like slapped in a 20 degree sideways. Yes.
It looks like it was put in an old typewriter and like
exactly the letters
are all a little off from each other.
And the manual is like on a very bad photocopier.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And I know it's really supposed to be that way because my copy was still sealed when I bought it.
Yep. Well, when I got mine back in, it was probably the 90s. You know, I got the Cosmi Top 20 Gold set. And, you know, I got that and I was like, you know, this looks great. You know, in the magazine, you get it. I open it up. I'm like, what is this? Did someone make this in their basement?
I know. And, I mean, not to be at fault there. At this time, they already had like mass production. So you had big labels like US Gold and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you had super quality print quality and something. And then you had such
the big ones at the time. You know, that wasn't a budget game house. They made like good quality games.
I know, but their reproduction facility was like shit.
Someone's basement.
No. Well, I mean, it was low cost. Not really invested a lot of money.
Yeah, good games though.
Yeah. And another game that hasn't been on the market for the last 5 years because of music licenses, and Sega said, no, we are not going to renew them, is actually the, as people say, cult classic, because it had bad reviews in 2010 when it was released, but it is actually the spy RPG Alpha Protocol and GOG, good old games, re-released it and patched it for HD and Windows 10, Windows 11. And right now you can even get it on a discount, 10% off.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. So, if you are into spy RPGs, I highly suggest give it a try.
Interesting. Yeah. It uses Unreal Engine 3.
Yeah.
Not bad looking. Graphics are a little, but, you know, it's 2010.
2010, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is, as I said, the history of the game, and it's actually one of the first games of its kind when it comes to the techniques used and stuff. And it's actually a contraction work by Sega. So Sega wanted that game to be made. So a lot of people forget that Sega isn't just Sonic the Hedgehog. They also contract other
Fantasy Zone. And the Snail in the Maze game that you get when you turn on a Master System without a cartridge in.
Or, except mine, I have one of the few Europeans that has no game inside.
That Snail in the Maze game and Space Harrier, my two top favorite Master System games.
Space Harrier, awesome music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They did the rendition of the arcade machine pretty well.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
The C64 did not.
I know. It's not very good. Not very.
It was a valiant try, but didn't quite make it.
Well, I mean, it's still amazed. It really depends on the skill of the people involved.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, look at Power Drift, for example, which is one of the best racing games on the C64, and it's actually a one-filer. Mm-hmm. And on the Amiga, it's absolutely horrible.
Mm.
And on the PC Engine, it's even beyond capable of. You really can't play that game and think it's very good. So it's actually amazing that the Static Spectrum and the 64 versions of the Power Drift conversion of the arcade is actually better than of those systems who are 16-bit and who should be more capable of playing the game. But the Amiga version especially is just a very taunting, slow frame rate where it's crawling like a slideshow.
That's a thing I've had with the Amiga, a complaint I've had with them, because I've got, you know, I have an A500 now, and it's a beefy A500, but even stock, it's capable of quite a bit. And a lot of the games I've got the 64 version, and I'm like, I want to see what the Amiga version is like, and I get it, and I'm like, this is crap compared to the 64. And a lot of times that's because the DOS PCs at the time were not as capable as an Amiga 500. The 500 was way more capable than these DOS PCs of like the 80s. But the Amiga often got a straight conversion of the DOS version.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case here.
I'm just saying a lot of them do, whereas the 64 was its own kind of version of that because the architecture was so different. But the Amiga, a lot of times it uses the same graphic assets, the same audio assets. It's like you play it, and even some really good games, like if you Wing Commander on the Amiga, the graphics and the music could be so much better than they are, but they're using the assets from the PC version.
But then you have the same problem with some C64 games. Mm-hmm. For example, Karnov. Mm-hmm. Is a straight conversion of the Static Spectrum release, which is why it has the same color palette.
Right.
But it still plays okay, mm-hmm. you know, frame rate wise and stuff, you know. But then you have horrible examples like Chase HQ,
mm-hmm.
where the same like Power Drift on the Amiga, the frame rate is just horrible, and the color palette is also from the Spectrum.
Right, and you get other games. You know, one of my favorite games ever on the 64 is this game called Space Rogue. It's a role-playing space flight simulator kind of game. It really advanced for its time. I think it was like made in like 87 or something. And I loved that game on the 64. I've played it probably 1,000 times through. And I was like, you know, okay, I've got the Amiga. I want to see what the Amiga version looks like, because it's got to be awesome compared to that. And the pictures on the back of the box that show Amiga look great. It's trash. The C64 version is 100 times better than the Amiga version.
Mm.
You know, the Amiga version, maybe it's got a little bit higher frame rate, but the graphics are no better. The sound effects are worse. At least the 64, like, they made use of the palette they had, and the 64 has that kind of, like, muted kind of, you know, earthy palette. They made good use of that. But on the Amiga, you don't, they don't, it's like these bright colors, you know, like your CGA standard colors. It looks like trash, you know? And it's like, it's disappointing, you know, to see this conversion of this game, which should be so much better, and it's not.
However, I have to put you wrong here. Most games that were made on the Amiga were actually Atari conversations.
Yeah.
Atari ST conversations.
Which is even worse because the Atari was really limited as far as like audio and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it had the MIDI, but the built-in audio was not as good as the Amiga's was.
Or even the Atari ST had a different issue, though, and that was not the music, but it didn't have features like hardware scrolling.
Right, exactly. It didn't.
That is why games like Gianna Sisters on the Atari ST doesn't have scrolling. It goes screen-wise.
Did it have sprites? I can't. Well, yeah, I think it had sprites, but
yeah,
there was
but
something.
No hardware scrolling.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah.
Just later on in the lifetime of the Atari ST, some coders invented techniques for scrolling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as always, games tend to be better.
I mean, the 64 can do smooth scrolling, so it's like it's a waste if something like an ST, the ST can't do that. You know?
Yeah. Nowadays we know better, and the coders, of course, know there are techniques to work around that. But back then, when the commercial market was beginning, companies didn't really, you know, invent new techniques to make the hardware do things it's not supposed to do. That just came later, you know.
That's the thing that always upset me about C64 games. If I got a game on the C64 and I ran the game, and the first thing I noticed was that it used the built-in font and all uppercase. Like they didn't even bother to change it to the lowercase version. I'm like, all right, not playing this game at all. I've lost.
Yeah,
all
but those are early 80s games.
There were some into the 90s that were like that. They just didn't bother with it. You know, it's like
but
that
those were not AAA good.
No,
quality games. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, those are the news I've got.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. I got nothing, so.
Nice. So let's jump to France.
Yes.
And learn about new hardware developments for the NES and new games. Awesome. Croissant. Oh, my God. Today, we have another podcast, and today we have two guests, and of course, with me, AJ. And today we will be talking about the upcoming NES game that actually has a Wi-Fi model included, and that's Super Tilt Pro. And to talk about that, we actually have the CEO of Prog Studio, the publisher, Antoine Gouhon, and I probably said it wrong, I'm sorry. Okay. And Roger Bidon, the coder and developer of the game. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi.
And prior to this interview, I already found out that actually the studio, Prog Studio, was founded for Twin Dragons that released in 2018 for the NES that I also backed on the Kickstarter. So really, really, really happy to talk to you finally. And and as I understood, it will also be the first interview in English. So thanks for coping with us.
second one.
Yeah, for you, exactly. Yes, well, so perhaps let's start a bit with how you guys actually got involved into game developing for the NES, because I guess that's not something everybody in France would do nowadays. So I don't know who of you guys want to start.
Well, I can.
Yeah.
You want? Okay. So for me, I was programming since I was a little boy.
Oh.
Because my dad was programming before it was even cool. And then I got studying at university and get a job in programming. And then I became an adult, and my dad had to clean a room, and I got my NES back, my NES. I didn't know what to do with that. I played the old game, it was cool. And then just check it on the internet, what's inside, maybe I can program that. And the trick is that it's super fun to program. That's completely different from programming nowadays, because we have JavaScript, C#, and that stuff. At that time, it was assembly, working with the internals. So it's completely different, and a new world opened. And I'm still programming on it. That's
awesome.
My story.
Awesome.
And you, Antoine?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in programming in general. And when I was a kid, like Roger, I played on an Amstrad CPC. Don't know if you know microcomputer, a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And I played a lot of games, and each time I played a game, I was asking to my dad, but how games are made? That was the question I had. So he told me basic stuff, like the basic language, but not that much because he wasn't interested in video games. So growing up, I did studies to code websites, which is completely different from video games. After that, I was into music, so really a different thing. And at some point, I had a lot of time, free time for me. And I thought, why not try to code a video game now that I can? And the idea was to do it for the Amstrad CPC or the NES. Because I had the CPC, but I didn't have the NES when I was a kid, so I played at friends. And the NES, I found a lot of documentation for the NES at the time, so I thought, why not? And that's how we started, coding prototypes, very little games, until I started to code Twin Dragons in 2016, late 2016. And everything started from that time.
And that's also how you ended up founding Prague Studio in the end.
Yeah, because I wanted to, when I did the first demo of Twin Dragons, it was really well received, and I thought, why not make a complete game, and add a physical version for it. So once it was released, I had the knowledge how to make a physical edition of a NES game. And I thought, why not offer the services for other developers? And that's how Prague Studio started. And so the second game on the web shop was Micromages, which was a huge success. And it really helped the studio to grow.
Awesome. So let me ask you, is that your full-time job or is it more like a hobby?
No, it is a full-time job now. We are two people at Prague Studio full-time. And I think a third one would be nice now to give some help to assemble every games, ship every packages. So that's a good problem to have. But yeah, this is a full-time job now.
All right, nice. So now, of course, the next logical question would be, to Roche, why making a game that uses the internet for the NES? How did that happen? I mean, you know, I mean, there are some complications. I guess the first thing I have to do once I receive the cartridge, I have to remove the RF shielding off my consoles.
Probably.
So perhaps you can talk a bit about that.
Yes. So when it comes to put a Wi-Fi, that's as I said, I programmed the Super Tilt/Bro as a little demo to know what we can do with the NES. I was happy with it. It was really roots a game for the retro community. And then Antoine came with the idea to put internet on the NES. And I was hyped like I never had been hyped. That's the thing I wanted when I was a young boy. I heard stories about Japan where they have internet in their console. And it was the opportunity to make it real. So I got the step further. I came from a little game enjoyed by those who love the NES to make a real game that anybody can like and help to make the Wi-Fi chip a reality too. And I play with my shield on the NES. There is no problem with that.
Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know, because that was my first thought, you know. Probably it would hinder the Wi-Fi signals, but if you say it's fine. One thing that I really found interesting, I saw that in the Kickstarter, mentioned it also on the YouTube channel, and I guess we should mention it because we are called Scene World. You also said, you announced you would make sure that the game works on NTSC and the PAL version of the console. So perhaps let's talk a bit about that, because I think that's very important nowadays, especially as it is kind of a competitive brawler game. You would have a disadvantage if one person is in Europe and has a slower running game than the American or Canadian counterpart. So can we talk a bit about that? Because I have been tester for NES games in the past, and I figured that the detection whether the NES runs on NTSC and PAL is pretty troublesome. Sometimes it's detected wrong. That is why some projects actually make separated releases of the cartridge. And so I would like to know, what's your approach of making the game compatible to all variants of the NES? Because, for example, I have one from Venezuela, because the ones from America were too expensive for me.
Okay, so there's a lot of stuff to say about NTSC and PAL. Oh, you say PAL.
PAL, yeah. PAL. Yeah. I don't know, AJ. Would you say PAL in English or what?
No, I always say PAL.
PAL. Okay.
PAL. Okay. Let's say PAL. So yes, the main difference between the two is the frame rate. So one is not running slower, but one is printing less frame per second. So the first step I had to mitigate the difference. So the game, like you said, detect if it's NTSC or PAL, and adjust some constant in the game, like you run 3 pixels per frame. On PAL, you run a little less, and in the outcome, the character run at the same speed for you. So you don't see the difference. There is a minor difference, because you can go 1 pixel further or 1 pixel less. And in the fighting game, it can be the difference between dying or surviving. So you don't feel the difference, but it exists. So to play online with one in PAL and one in NTSC, the console in NTSC, which run 60, sorry, I have trouble with numbers, 60 frames per second, undercap herself, it limits, and to run like if it run 50 frames per second. I don't know if it's clear. So the NTSC system runs slower to match the speed of the PAL system.
So you took the approach of concentrating on the NTSC first and then slowing it down for the European release, kind of.
Just online, just for playing an European. If I play with an American player, the American player will run at the speed of my system to match the boss. If we play locally, the system play 60 frames per second.
So it's kind of awesome. So yeah, so it slows down, but only if one of the components, one of the opponents is actually from Europe and uses a different NAS. Oh, that's super clever. So it's kind of auto sensing. Oh, it's super, super clever approach. Wonderful. Yeah, because, well, as I said, most games are using a totally different approach.
Not doing it at all. I mean, we've played games where, you know, it's not even matched because I'm in NTSC and he's in PAL. And it's
right. For example, NetRazor. NetRazor for the Commodore. If you run it on an, if you run it on a PAL C64 machine and you race against an NTSC racer, your car is slower, so you never can win a race. So it's wonderful that you approach it that way. So but I guess it's also kind of complex because the music and everything around it still has to play on the other speed of the machine, right? So it sounds super complex to me.
Yes, especially on the NES, there is no timer for the music. We use the frame timer to get the music going. So we have the problem with music playing slower when on PAL. And for that, the trick is to sometimes tweak tick twice the music engine on the frame. So every 5 frame we'll tick one more, and in the error it's okay.
Awesome. Yeah. So I also wonder how you will go about the infrastructure, because there is a version on each IO that you actually can play online, and so far I only found 2 servers for America and for Europe. But I wonder, how about, for example, Latin America? I mean, there is a huge scene in Brazil for those machines, for example. And as I said, I got my NAS from Venezuela, actually, you know? So there should be a few more servers, I think. Just my personal opinion.
Yes, it's my opinion too, but server cost me money each month. And so I have to select region where players are. There's 2 points to mitigate that. The first is, I don't know if I say it enough, but the game is open source. The server is a web, so it's tricky, but you can recompile the server and run it at home. Another is a plan in the future to go microservices. I can pop server on demand where player are.
Wow.
For now, I just pay a small server and I have to limit the reach.
Awesome. Yeah, wonderful. So I see you really thought this through. So there will always be a free open source version of the game. So Does that include the Wi-Fi model of the game? I mean, the Kickstarter is over now. I think you also sell it on your homepage now. But I don't know. Will it be unlimited supply, or perhaps you can answer that, Antoine? What's the future plan of the game? Because a lot of Kickstarter games, you know, they are only available for a limited time, and then at some point the game is sold out. For example, I don't see Twin Dragons on your homepage in your store right now.
Really? No. It is available.
Not on the front page, but perhaps I have to go deeper. All right.
If you go in the NES category, you should see it.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, so the question is, what's the idea of the availability of the game, so that people who didn't catch the Kickstarter can enjoy it?
So the idea with Brook Studio was to offer the games unlimitedly, so the games are always available on the shop. We didn't want to offer limited editions. We only do limited editions during Kickstarter's campaigns. But the games on the shop should be always available, as long as the developer or we don't break the contract we have. But we don't want to end a game. We think that wouldn't be fair. So the game should be available as long as it's possible.
And now that you offer the Wi-Fi functionality in the cartridge, can we talk a bit about the challenges you had as a publisher regarding hardware development there? I mean, it's something you generated from the ground up. I guess it hasn't been done before, so perhaps you can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so the idea of using Wi-Fi with the NES started in 2018, I think. Yeah. Something like that, and other people already way smarter than me already tried to do it and successfully do it. I can think of Rachel Simon Wales, I think, and members, two members of the NES Dev community, and surely other people. So their work really inspired me, and I looked how they did it at the time. Tried to do something similar. So the first prototype was something you plugged in the second controller port, but it wasn't really fast and it wasn't easy to get it to work on NTSC and PAL. So I quickly moved to putting the Wi-Fi chip directly on the cart, because that's where you could have the greatest speed to communicate. And it took time because I couldn't work it full time all the year. So it took some time. And of course, once you start to work with hardware stuff, you always think of new stuff to add, and it can be pretty endless if you don't stop yourself. So now I am the point. I'm at the point when Roger is telling me, now you have to stop and we have to release the game. And we are almost there. So that's good news. But I learned a lot of stuff doing that, because I never did something like this before. That's also one of the reasons it took so long. But it's a really cool project, really proud of it, really proud of what Roger did with it. That's surely the best game to showcase what's possible to do with the Wi-Fi on the NES. So
yes,
so cool.
That's the best Wi-Fi game on the NES.
Period.
I'm pretty sure.
awesome, yeah. I mean, also the problem is here, you have to take into account that perhaps in the future you will have to update the cartridge in a way. because if you go back in history, how Wi-Fi started, like WEP protocol, for example, wouldn't be even available in some routers anymore to select for the Wi-Fi security. So in the future, you might have to make an update to the cartridge to support newer encryption protocols in the Wi-Fi infrastructure, or perhaps, well, remove insecure security protocols. Just my thought. I mean, you know, I mean, I can't take a printer from 20 years ago and connect it to my Wi-Fi nowadays.
Well, but the Wi-Fi they're using, I think, that's the what chip is that? That's the it's the Wi-Fi chip that a lot of things use. I can't think of what it is.
The ESP8266.
Yes, that's the one. Yes, yeah. And that's pretty. That's fairly robust. I mean, that's I've got Wi-Fi running on both of these ancient machines using one of those. So I think that's fairly easy. If anything does need to be done to it, I think it's fairly easy to roll that out in firmware.
Yeah, so it can be updated, of course. We anticipate it. Like you can update the cartridge, you can update the Wi-Fi chip if there's a bug to fix or another feature to add, maybe, I don't know. I'm not the network expert, Roger is, so he will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the protocol we use to connect Wi-Fi to communicate using Wi-Fi are pretty standard, and I don't think that it will change in the next, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years. That's been around for a while now, so I don't think they will make something new and ditch what was existing before instantly, so I think we should be good for that. Hopefully.
Awesome. Absolutely happy to hear. So if I understood it correctly, there are two ways of the game actually sensing the speed of the console. Once, as you said, Rocher, during a match on the fly, depending on what system the opponent uses. But I guess also when you are playing locally and you switch between an American and European console, the same game will also switch in general, right?
Yes. The exact thing is at boot, the game check. It check exactly the time between frames. In CPU cycles, it couldn't simply it let one game one frame pass, and it couldn't the speed of the CPU, and say, oh, that's a NTSC, oh, that's a PAL, oh, that's a Dendy. Say it's a Dendy.
that's
never tried.
I also got it.
Should be detected. And after that, it cap all the speed in games to awesome. So it's not felt the controller in the end you don't see the difference. And when connecting with an opponent, the first thing the NES say is to say, hey, I'm PAL. The other say, hey, I'm an NTSC. Okay, we'll play like a PAL. And at that time the NTSC pick ourselves to run slower and like a PAL to be still felt the same.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm so happy to hear, because as I said, there are so many developers that gave up on this detecting what kind of speed an NES is running. So it's great to hear that you found out a way that works, you know. So wonderful. Perhaps let's talk a bit about the gameplay, because we didn't do that yet. So actually the game has been there before the Kickstarter already in a free version, right, on itch.io, if I'm not mistaken. And so the functionality for the online play actually came afterwards, right?
Yes, the game came first on itch.io and on a cartridge I made at home myself, so, with solder iron and stuff. And without Wi-Fi, nothing. And then Wi-Fi came with a prototype of the game version and emulator that that tried to follow the hardware and continue to evolve. So now we have a little community with the game, of people who play, who comment on the last touch, who say, oh, tell us, this character is too powerful, this character is not enough powerful. So the game is living before the cartridge, and will continue to evolve. Because with Wi-Fi we can play, but we can also update the game. So we can continue to change the balance or add contents.
Yeah.
The cartridge is an event in the life of the game, but the life of the game is larger than just that.
It's interesting. And so that means in a few years, your self-made cartridge versions will be selling for thousands on eBay because it's becoming rare, you know?
I think there is already one on eBay, but nobody wants to pay for that.
Ah.
Perhaps. How many did you make? How many did you make cartridges?
I made two batches, one of 9 cartridge because I buy to make 10 and burnt one with my own solder. And another batch of 60.
Not bad.
Hmm.
Not bad for home production.
Yeah.
Yes, I was surprised. I thought the 9 ones was more than enough. I wanted to sell it at a convention, and I was sold out before the convention. I wanted to. I went. Hey, we sell you Super Turbo, and the opening happened. I had only one left because all my friends and my coworker already got one.
Wow. Okay. Interesting story. So will the free version on itch.io, will that remain once the physical cartridge with the Wi-Fi chip is out? Can I play with my friends who don't have an NES in the end?
Yes, that's the trick. We can play on the NES. We can play on emulator on Windows, Linux, and macOS. And we can also play on the web browser on itch.io. And there is a crossplay for all that stuff.
Awesome.
Everybody can play with everybody. Very simple.
Awesome. So I'm very happy to hear that Prague Studio isn't against keeping the free version up on itch.io and stuff. Because one would think that now that it's hardly, I mean, or how to say, seriously commercial. I mean, there were some other examples. For example, Pico Entertainment, when they took some licenses, they removed some free games on Steam because now it's seriously commercial. So glad to hear that that you guys from Prog Studio keep the free stuff up.
Yeah. So I'm a developer before Prog Studio, so I know the two sides of the job, I can say, right. And I don't want to impose stuff to developers, or at least the less I can. So of course sometimes we can disagree, but no, if Roger tells me no, I want the game to stay open source and I want it to stay free on the internet, I don't see any reason for me to disagree with that. Roxidio, we are here to sell physical version of the game. So people who want a physical version, they can buy it. If they want to play online, they can play online. No reason to try to shut this down. That would be a nonsense for me.
And I must add, it's great because going open source, I hope sincerely that I will never be published and just self-publish as open source. So getting a publisher was unexpected. Getting a publisher that accepts it's still free, that's golden and rare. And thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, how many options are there on the NES? I don't know. I don't know of many, you know, especially in Europe, you know.
How many what?
I mean, how many options for different publishers on the NES do you have nowadays? Not a lot, I guess.
In Europe especially, or?
Yeah, I mean, otherwise you would have the problems, you know, with customs and import-export, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know, in Europe you have some, I think First Press Games are doing NES stuff. Megacat Studios in the US.
Megacat, yeah, exactly.
We got in France.
Watermelon, very famous Watermelon.
Yeah, but only for Genesis Mega Drive. For DNS, we don't have much publisher, I think. Or maybe it's only for one or two games. Dragon Box in Germany.
Right.
So there are some options, but I guess we are the only one with Wi-Fi option.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder, you said there were many attempts that failed. What did you make difference to be successful in this Wi-Fi matter?
As I said, the first version was the one you plugged in the second controller port.
Exactly.
It was slow, so this one was quickly discarded. And then the real challenge was to design the board, the PCB, and to learn how to, I don't know if code is the right word for FPGAs, but how to program the FPGA and to get everything to communicate efficiently. That was the first time for a lot of stuff in this project. So learn everything, trial and errors. You make many prototypes. I don't know, maybe four or five. I didn't keep count. So yeah, and now we have this one, which works perfectly fine.
Awesome.
So yeah, that's cool.
Are you going to think of licensing out the technology to do this to other developers?
That's not planned for now. I guess that's something we'll keep to ourselves for now. Maybe in the future, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. But that's not something that is planned for the moment.
Okay.
I totally didn't ask, will there be a Famicom version, or will you just send it out with an adapter for Japanese guys?
Can you do a Famicom? Well, I mean, yeah, I guess with an adapter you can.
Yeah, there will be a Famicom version. I really don't know when yet, because the cartridges are smaller, so
exactly,
we have
that's
to get everything to fit. And that's not that easy, but I really want to make a Famicom one. Yeah.
I mean, we all know that Nintendo themselves cheated with the NES releases of their Famicom games at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
They just put in a Famicom adapter and called it an NES release.
like Rob, the first version of Rob, Jeromite.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there you have the other issue that you have to make everything smaller. And I saw in the YouTube video the Wi-Fi antenna is just a small trace on the motherboard.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Oh my god!
It just this part, like I don't know if you can see it, but yeah, just the part. Yep. Yeah.
Like, oh my god, you know.
I don't think that hinders it anyway. I think that's pretty common. Yeah, it's the same on the C64 Wi-Fi adapter right up there.
Yep. Awesome. Yeah, so Roger, you mentioned you are changing the balance of the characters in the game. So are there any plans for the gameplay of the game, or some improvements over your self-made version? I mean, there's also a story mode that people can play and stuff, but other than balance changes?
Yes, there is already a story mode, so we are approaching release, so it's ready. So it's a small story mode. The main thing is playing 1v1 competitively.
Of course.
So yes, balance is a real thing in this context, because competition is a real impact, and I think the game is really better each time the balance change. And I have plan. I don't know if I'll have time, but I have plan for other character. I have the space in the cartridge, and when I do it, it will be free to upgrade.
Awesome. Yeah, that was a question that I had. You know, there's several characters. I think there's one, two, three, there's like four characters, I think. Yeah. Yeah, so how much time was spent like developing that? Because these aren't like borrowed from other games or anything. These are actually characters for this game.
Yeah, for developing a character at the time. That's yes. I observed that it's a roughly 1 month to get a character from a good idea from what it will be. Often I get the character running in my head. I know what I want. And then when I say, no, I'm full time, we'll make the character. In 1 month later, I have the first draft that is really playable.
Okay.
So yes, a character is a month of full time work.
Yeah. Yeah, I see there's sketches and stuff and documentation that's on the Kickstarter page. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's quite a bit that goes into it.
Yeah, I mean, with this Wi-Fi technology, you could make so many wonderful stuff. For example, a new NES racing game again over the internet or something. You know, wow, that would be something. Because I'm a lover for
He's
the racer
genre.
I'm obsessed with racing games, right? So I seriously hope you will come up with more games using the Wi-Fi model and functionality, because, you know, imagine the possibilities. Amazing.
Yeah, I know at least one person that is working on a game that should be using the board, the Wi-Fi board. So I really don't have any idea when it will be out, but it will be a rhythm game. What is it called? No, so the game name is Tactus, and it's inspired of another indie game, which is Necromancer Dance, something like that. Sorry, which is it's like roguelike dungeon. You walk into dungeon and you have to kill enemies on the rhythm of the music, and it should be pretty fun. So there's a demo of the game that he did for the NES Dev competition last year, I think. So it's this demo is already available, and yeah, he started working with the board, and I just realized I'm saying nonsense thing here, because he won't be using the Wi-Fi stuff. He's just using features that are on the board, but not the Wi-Fi stuff.
Oh, okay.
So I guess maybe the next Wi-Fi game will be mine. I don't know if one day I have time to code again. Sorry for that.
This is all the CEO stuff. You barely have time for coding.
Yeah, this is mostly the assembly and shipping time that takes really, really long. Assembling the games for people who, because we have games we sell on the shop, and we have people that ask us to assemble their game and ship their game for them, but that are not on the shop. Like, oh. I don't know if you heard of From Below and From Below Pocket. From Below for the NES and From Below Pocket for the Game Boy. So he sold the games on his shop, and then he asked us to assemble the games and ship to every customer. So we do that a lot for other developers. That's not something that is visible to regular customers, but it takes a lot of time. So yeah, quite busy with this.
So you don't have an assembly line, it's all handmade?
Yeah, it's all handmade by me.
Really? So you are there with a soldering gun and soldering all the cartridges together and putting the components on and stuff.
Yeah, the PCB arrives already assembled, so I don't have to solder anything. Maybe some jumpers sometimes, but it's already assembled. I just flash the games, assemble the cartridges, test the game in the console, and assemble the packaging.
Wow. You must have a whole collection of different NES variants and machines for the games, especially for Roche's game. Now that you mentioned that you even make it compatible with the Dendy, which is kind of a hybrid, because it's a PAL machine with an Famicom connector.
Yeah, I don't have that much different models, honestly. I got one NTSC NES, a top loader NES, some PAL models, and yeah, the Famicom and Twin Famicom, but that's it. I don't have any exotic models or clones, so... It should work everywhere.
Yeah, so you're also working with emulators, I guess, at some point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, wonderful. So are there any future plans of the game? Some features you're still adding, or are you basically complete now and you are just waiting for the hardware production to finish and then you ship out to the Kickstarters, I guess?
In the game itself, I think we're almost ready for release. So I moved my versioning number to release candidate. Sometime one of these will just become the 2.0 and basta. And I don't know what I had to say, but it was important, I guess.
Never mind.
I guess player feedback will maybe give you ideas to things to update or maybe add, depending on what they have to say about the game.
Yes, but as I said, there's a little community, so they are proficient for balance change. Notably, recently, the main character Sinbad had one big change just before release, so always tweaking. Maybe later, as I said, I may add other character. I have at least two ideas I'm okay with the developers from the original developer to add them, so I may add. And after that, we'll see. As you say, with feedback, as I like to say, Super Tilbro is a living game, so it continue to evolve. It will continue for the foreseeable future. So yes, if I have feedback, I can change things. If I don't have feedback, I change what I see and what I want. No, mostly what I want.
Okay.
Awesome.
I guess the next step will be to port the game to the SNES and have crossplay between NES and SNES.
Really? Is that the plan?
No, I'm just teasing. I'm just teasing.
I mean, look at other developers in the field. I mean, Xenocrisis, for example, they are still porting the game to new platforms like the Super NES. And I'm like, man, at some point, you know, how much can you port a game to, you know? It's like amazing, you know. But they stopped that now. Now they are working on the second Xenocrisis 2. So though it is surprising, but also very happy to hear that companies like Rogue Studio actually can make things for a living, you know, and not just a little hobby. Considering that some years ago it was still so much niche. That never would anybody take it as serious when I say, oh, I work for a publisher that publishes NES games and we are totally serious with it, you know.
Yeah, I guess we are very lucky about that, yeah. Clearly.
Exactly, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
And then even if you are successful, we know from other examples like unfortunately Watermelon. Where you can actually throw the company against the wall, you know, by bad managing of money and stuff, you know. So you can still fail even by being successful in the first place. But, you know, that's the thing, you know. I mean, you said releasing the game for NES. Is there any plans, any upcoming plans to perhaps support new platforms for Prog Studio or I don't know, is there anything? Are you planning to expand?
Yeah, of course. So we are already offering games for NES, Famicom, Game Boy and Mega Drive. So that's pretty cool. We have some games that for Game Boy that should be out this year. I think the next platform would be the SNES. That would make sense. And after that, I don't know. But the idea is to, if someone comes to us with a game that you want to publish and we don't support the platform now, that could be the opportunity of doing it.
Right. I'm not aware of anybody who does Game Gear games. New Game Gear games.
We have a publisher in France that specialized in Game Gear and Master System, which is Two Minds game.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
Interesting.
Really great quality products.
See. You are more in the game when it comes to French publishers than me. it's interesting. I mean, especially Rocher, since you mentioned it's different coding on the NES. I just read an article the other day how much more difficult it is to develop games on the NES compared to the Game Boy. So I'm not a coder, but I read that some things that are simple on the Game Boy are super complicated to code on the NES.
I didn't try to code on the Game Boy, so I don't really know. But I was surprised because coding on the NES is deceptively easy. Mm. So we think it's hard, and actually it's not that hard. It's impressive because it's assembly, it's a little CPU that can multiply numbers. But In fact, once we learn the assembly, which is small and easy to learn, it's just more verbose, but pretty easy, I find.
Yeah, I guess the most difficult thing is to work around the hardware limitation more than the language itself. Yep. Because you have to work with the palettes for the colors, mostly graphic stuff, the attributes, stuff like that, which can be a bit tricky for when you start.
Yes, the road to success is to be a bottom eye, to think, I must do 8x8 tiles. I have 4 color. Okay, what I can do with that? Yeah. More than top to low. I want a game with a lot of colors, lot of scoring. How I implement that you will hurt a wall rapidly.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, if they're not coders. You know, I was a coder on the C64. It's a 6510, very similar to the 502. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, assembly language is mostly just storing values to memory locations. And so there's like lots of tables you have to have from like, okay, here's where I can put things here, and here's where things go here, and what that means. And there's just a lot of that you need to keep track of with it. But it's not that hard once you figure it out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I don't know if I can pinpoint you on something, but Ben, are you planning to release the game to wrap it up?
So the release date on the Kickstarter was April 2024, which is pretty soon now.
Yes.
As Roger said, the game is ready. All the print stuff are ready. So we have to pick everything at the printer, but everything is ready. We already have the shells. We just need the PCBs, and I need to stop adding stuff to the PCB, which should happen pretty soon now. But we should be on time, April or May at the latest, I think. But
that would be one of the few Kickstarters that actually that actually matches the original release date, because normally Kickstarters are way off, you know. It's amazing. But I guess you have the experience now, so you know what you are working with, right?
Yeah, this one is very special because of this Wi-Fi thing, where you can easily brick the cart. You don't want to send 1,000 card in everywhere and have people telling you, okay, I tried to update the game, and now I can't do anything with my cart. And I really want to avoid that.
Yes. You have to implement a fallback in case updating process fails and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Roger did it for the game. I did it for the Wi-Fi chip firmware. So it should work, but I prefer to take, if I need 1 or 2 extra months, to be sure that it can be an issue in the future.
Yeah, that would be, you know, I mean, if you're selling it to Japan and stuff, and then people have to ship it to France, so we can physically replace the components because something bricked. That would be very expensive on your side, because it's like warranty and stuff. I mean, we saw where it failed. You know, I don't know if you know, but Paprium, for example, it doesn't work on certain revisions of the Mega Drive. It simply crashes.
Yeah, the Mega Drive is a bit tricky for this because there are a lot of different revisions. And we published a game, The Cursed Knight, for the Mega Drive, and we had some issues with some very early Japanese versions, VA0, VA1 mostly, And like today, I got someone who sent me an email because the game crashed on his console, and it is a VA Dero Japanese version. So yeah, the Mega Drive is a bit tricky for this.
Now that's actually an interesting question. Will the game and the Vive adapter and everything, will it work on clone consoles? I mean, nowadays we have so many aftermarket, especially NES machines.
So I don't have clones to test on. That's something I should buy one day. I guess if the clone is close enough to the original hardware, it should work. I don't see why it wouldn't work. But I guess we will know it once we send the cartridges, because I know that some people will try on clones. So
including
we'll know it at some point, and we'll just have to say, we did it for the original hardware. So
yeah, I mean, luckily you have companies like Analog who actually offer firmware updates for newer homebrew games. I remember when Unholy Knights was released on the SNES a few years ago. It took them half a year, but they fixed it. They fixed the console so the game doesn't crash and deface. And I was like, wow, that's impressive. But also, I mean, not everybody is paying 500 euros for a new console just to be able to play homebrew games in the future, you know. I mean, Analog is more a company for the rich people when you have a lot of money to waste, deep pockets, as you would say in English, you know. Right, you know, normally people just get a Retron 5 or something cheap that can't be updated, and then you got what you got. Interesting.
I guess the AVS from Retro USB is a cool alternative, and not too expensive.
Also true. Also true. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, I mean, so from my side, we got it covered. I don't know, AJ, have anything open to ask?
I think we covered it.
Awesome. So where can people find the game and then buy it, basically?
Well, we can already buy it on our shop as a pre-orders. It's the standard version. The limited version was only offered during the Kickstarter campaign. You can pre-order it on the website, brokestudio.fr. And I guess it will be shipped like a month after after we send the backers copies, something like that. So yeah, in the upcoming 4 months, I'd say April, May, June, something like that.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. And I also saw it's not very much super more expensive than regular games. I mean, for the Wi-Fi, it's just €5 more compared to the non-Wi-Fi games. That's fair.
Yeah, that's something we really tried from the beginning to keep game prices as low as we can. So it was €45 until the beginning of this month, 1st February, it was €45, and Super Tilt Bro was already €55. So we raised every game price to €50, but we kept Super Tilt Bro at €55. From what I looked, it's okay because the cartridges doesn't have all the components on board. We don't have a huge flash memory. We don't have flash memory for the graphics too, so we can keep the cost down to 55. Yeah.
Awesome.
We'll see in the future if we need to increase it, but I hope not.
Yeah, well, let's see how the economic economic situation in the world changes.
Yeah, that would be the surprise, I guess. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, thanks for sitting with us.
Sure.
It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. And keep in touch, right?
Yeah,
I will let you know.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Bye. Good evening. Bye-bye.